Now, there's travelling and there's travelling. Some people prefer a little bit of luxury. They like to go first or business class. They like to stay in five-star hotels. Then there's the other sort of travelling where you travel for the pure joy of it and for the interest, and you don't stay in magnificent hotels. You stay in as cheap accommodation as possible. Now, one of those people that's been on the road for a long time now, over 5 years, is Michael Britton. Michael is a painter. He's also a writer. He is also a long-term traveller. And so we are going to talk to Michael about the joys and the pitfalls of travelling on a low budget. Michael, you're in Thailand at the moment. You must have had a very long journey to get to Thailand. Can you sort of describe what sort of route you've taken to get there?
Been to Thailand a few times, enough to raise eyebrows of the immigration authorities. I recently just came back after 6 months in India. Spent a month in Sri Lanka just to recover. And just mosey on up to Pai here in the northwest corner of Thailand to, again, catch my breath, recalibrate what it is and why I'm actually doing this to myself, this traveling.
You say why you're doing that to yourself, because I understand that you had a bit of a problem in Varanasi in India. You caught typhoid, is that right?
Yeah, I got myself a good dose.
What are the medical conditions like up there in Varanasi?
Well, let's see. I was flat on my back in a dingy hotel room. Had bed bugs for company, so it wasn't too bad, and well entertained by hallucinations. I had never been so sick in my life. After about 22 days, the manager finally decided to open up my hotel room. I think he was expecting a corpse on the bed and thinking, oh, Christ, I'm going to have to change the bed sheets.
Well, he changes the top sheet for the bottom sheet. They just switch them around, I think.
Yeah, exactly. But in this case, it was in pretty bad shape. And so they carried me down the stairs to and across the street to the local doctor. And I'd say for a 14-year-old, he was quite competent.
Right. The doctor, you mean?
Yeah. It was a street-side clinic. Unfortunately, my health insurance has a $500 deductible, and I would literally die first before paying that. So I figured for $10, I'll see what this kid can do for me. He gave me a bag full of stuff to take, and it actually worked.
When you say a bag full of stuff, was it sort of natural remedy, or was it what we would recognize as Western medicine?
It was Ayurvedic medicines, and I supplemented that with heavy doses of antibiotics. There are after effects of typhoid.
When you were lying there on the bed, was that perhaps the loneliest you've ever felt in your life?
Yeah, I nearly called it quits. I was just ready to cash in my chips and just head on back to the West.
Do you have a support network in the West that can help you if you really, really, really need it?
I hope so. I haven't really put it to the test. I have family.
Yeah.
And I'm sure they would come across, but I always keep a safety net. I always make sure I have enough money to last me 6 months.
And when you say last you 6 months, I'm assuming that your travels, you are traveling mainly through third world countries where it is cheaper to live on a day-to-day basis.
Exactly. I try to keep my budget to about $10 a day.
Despite the fact that you got typhoid in Varanasi, your overall experience of India, how was that?
You know, sometimes you just absolutely hate India. It's always in your face, and yet there's a wonderment to it that actually seems to be calling me back to it. I intend going back there at the end of next month and heading up into Kashmir.
Now, Kashmir is going to be a brave call because, of course, that's where the highest war in the world is being fought out at the moment. Although I do understand that they are letting people back in there now. I know people that have been up there, but you certainly don't seem to be the type of person that is going to avoid places because there is the prospect of danger there.
Oh, nah. I look forward to the danger myself. Makes for a good story. you know, it's so overwrought. I mean, that so-called highest elevated war, that's been going on for decades.
Once in a while,
they fire a shell here and there, but it doesn't affect the day-to-day living of people.
No, I was actually talking to a guy who trekked through the Himalayas, and he actually had to walk through that region. And he said that because he was a Westerner, he was pretty much left alone. People wondered why he was there. But at no stage, well, he didn't feel in any danger from that. There might have been other dangers, such as high treks or dodgy paths or whatever, But from that perspective, he said he didn't feel in any danger at all.
No, very seldom, very seldom. I think the biggest danger, as you said, is dodgy paths or just walking on scree and slipping and going for a long, ugly ride.
When you move around, do you use public transport or do you do a lot of walking or is it a combination of both? I suppose it depends where you are as well as to how you move around.
It is. I usually use public transportation. In India, that means riding in very crowded buses.
Yep.
Fortunately, they don't let you ride on top of the bus anymore.
Don't they?
I think the government felt that was just way too much fun. So they outlawed the practice and they cram us all inside. And of course, your ticket doesn't guarantee a seat. It just guarantees you maybe getting on the bus if you're aggressive enough.
Do you find that you have to be a little bit aggressive sometimes in order to get yourself on in those situations?
I'm passive aggressive.
Does that mean that you just sort of push gently?
I push gently, I smile, and if an elbow is called for, it's ready.
Do you find, because you're a Westerner, people, I know that in India they stare at you, but do you feel that they treat you a little bit differently than they would to, say, another local so that they may make way for you to get on a bus or whatever?
No. It's everyone for themselves.
I suppose it's the sort of place where it's got to be, hasn't it? I mean, that is such a mass of humanity, which is sort of crammed into a reasonably small space. I mean, they've got almost the same population as China, but China is very, very much larger, about 3 or 4 times larger than India.
Exactly. But, you know, not every place in India is crowded. There's some places are quite sparsely populated and others are just huge crushes of people. These days, I think most Indians are drawn to the cities for economic reasons.
Yeah.
But the rural areas, it's not a crush of people. There's lots of villages, but India actually has more agricultural land than China does.
China, of course, hasn't got much arable land because of mountains and deserts and all sorts of other little things that India tends not to have.
Exactly.
Have you been to China as well?
No, I haven't been. And the only reason for that is the visa problem.
Yeah, they are very strenuous about your visas. And I think the most you can get is about a 3-month visa and you have to leave the country in order to get that renewed. So that could be a little bit difficult for someone like yourself. However, I have met people like that because I used to go to China a lot and I have met people who overstayed their visas. And I don't think the consequences of doing that are very pleasant.
I don't live by many rules, but the one rule that I do respect stridently is never overstay a visa.
No, but I would imagine the way you travel, you meet a lot of Westerners who are traveling the same way. And I bet that you've met a lot that have sort of been stuck in places, run out of money, and have just been stuck, and the visa is the least of their problems.
There are. Usually in Malaysia. Malaysia, it's a little bit more relaxed. Not in terms of the authorities, but you don't need a passport to check into every hotel, or they just find a place in the hills and they just stay there for months and months until they work something out.
Malaysia is not actually a bad place to visit. It's quite a good standard of living compared to other parts of Asia.
Yeah, in most parts. But I find the standard of living up here is not as strenuous as most people would think. They actually live, I think, quite simple lives. You know, most of the people I meet here are quite happy.
Have you been affected by the political situation in Thailand? Indeed, have the people up there? Because as you probably know, I should imagine you listen to the news, there's been a military coup and the whole country is under martial law. Has there been any sort of effect on you or effect on the local people, do you think?
Interestingly enough, just going to the market today, notice all these little school children wearing uniforms. Now, maybe it was just a Boy Scout jamboree. Yeah, all these military-like uniforms on the little kids. It's a bit interesting. I decided not to ask questions, just thought, well, best to just keep my mouth shut and head low and see what develops. But I haven't seen that before.
You spend a lot of time living on a tight budget. I would imagine that you need to carry a lot of your resources with you, money and et cetera. What about your own personal security or security of valuables? How worrisome is that for you?
I always have to be cognizant of that. Never want to lose your passport. That's the worst thing.
Yeah.
I keep it in a pouch that's tied to my pants, tied to my belt, and tucked into my groin. They pretty much have to marry me to get to the goods.
Can I just say, Michael, I'm very pleased that I am not your passport.
Yeah, I know. But, you know, security does come first.
Exactly, it does. You had some great adventures. One of your most memorable adventures, I should say, was a journey on a Pelni ferry to Phat Phat in Irian Jaya. Now, most people have never heard of Phat Phat, and it's sort of, you've got to be careful how you say that. But of course, most people don't know Irian Jaya, which is now known as West Papua, and it's part of the the island of New Guinea, but it is the Indonesian part. Was it difficult to negotiate your way in those areas? Because West Papua, there are a lot of political problems there. And the Indonesians are very careful about who they let in.
There were. As soon as I arrived in Irian Jaya, it was like 2 o'clock in the morning, stepped off the ferry, and my first contact was with the local police. And their first question was, you have a permit? I, of course, replied, I don't need no stinking permit. Oh, with a big smile, of course.
Of course, yeah.
And got hauled off to the local police station and thoroughly grilled about what I was doing there. This was in a lovely little place called Kamana. They grilled me for about an hour and a half, telling me that, well, I need to go back to Jakarta.
That's not very far, is it? It's only about, 3,000 kilometers or something.
Yeah, exactly. Well, 5 days on a ferry.
Yeah.
The next ferry wasn't due for another 10 days.
Right.
So they had to decide what they were going to do with me. I think they just started to get bored with me because I can be a little too chatty with them. And they were pointing at my painting easel, wondering what that was. And so I showed them all my paintings and didn't make a sale, of course. But
it sort of would have broken the ice, I guess.
Broke the ice. And the trick is always carry cigarettes. I don't smoke, but I always carry a pack of cigarettes.
Do you try to carry American cigarettes or the local stuff?
By now it's the local stuff. Everyone has their favorite brands, but just offering them a cigarette, especially the police, is always a good icebreaker. And then after my interrogation, they marched me over to the local hotel and thoroughly intimidated the night clerk. Yeah, you have to imagine it was 5 army fatigued police, and they're toting guns and all the toys. And I got a special rate for the hotel.
Yeah.
I got a discount.
Of course.
Which is great.
Because the police had recommended you stay there.
Exactly. With just the admonition to report to headquarters in the morning, which I didn't do.
No. So you had 10 days there before you could get out anyway. What did you do?
Basically, just live like the locals, just wander the streets, find places to paint, which is, mostly what I do.
In a place like West Papua, because it is pretty much undisturbed, you must have found some gems of places to paint.
Oh, yeah. But because it is so undiscovered, it's very hard to get into a lot of the gems. It's some real heavy bush to go through, and there's some real heavy critters crawling.
You tell me a story about a French Foreign Legion combat veteran who refers to himself as the boyfriend of death. Why does he do that?
Actually, apparently all combat troops of the Legionnaires call themselves that. They're boyfriends of death. I guess they just expect to die at any time. And he was regaling me with stories of, this very high suicide rate, in the barracks. His guns are very accessible, and they break up with girlfriends, or they get Dear John letters. He's quite an entertaining fellow.
Yeah, sounds like it.
Highly disturbed.
I was going to say, anybody who's a boyfriend of death must be very entertaining.
Yeah, oh, definitely.
Are they the sort of people you think, well, I'll listen to the stories, but I won't get too friendly?
Oh, I'm always friendly. We'd always go out into the park and drink a few pints of whiskey and keeping an eye out for the cops, because these are Muslim countries and you're not supposed to be drinking in public. But hell, we're boyfriends of death.
Yeah, that's right.
We can drink wherever we want.
Now, tell us about your painting. How do you sell them? Do you sell them online, or do you have a dealer that you send them to? And you're doing small paintings, aren't you? So you're not carting around huge canvases. You're carting around smaller canvases. So how do you sell them? Where do you sell them from?
I'll ship them back to a few of my dealers in the state. Many of them go to my sister in Canada. And I also sell them online as print, which helps finance my travels.
Okay. Well, that's probably a great way to finance your travels as well. And and you've always got plenty of output, because wherever you go, I'm sure there's always something that you want to paint.
Oh, there is, yeah. There has to be a rationale for long-term travel. Otherwise, you can quickly go to seed. I've seen lots of people just going to seed. They become lost after a few years. You can only go from place to place, visa to visa. Sooner or later, you're just going to be going from nullity to nullity. So
yeah. Do you have, during your travels, have you ever taken time out to say go home and see your family and have a bit of an R&R from all your traveling?
No, I haven't. I've been a bit negligent about that.
How do your family feel about that?
I think they're pretty used to me by now.
Yeah.
We connect through Skype and email and such. I think like any typical family, they'd be happy to see me for about a week or two, and then the stories grow old and they don't want to hear more travel stories, and it might be time to move on again, hit the road.
You also say you've met a few of your fellow travelers, people that have, say, been diagnosed with cancer or who have some other ailment, and they've decided that the way they want to go is on the road, and so they just hit the road and travel. They must be pretty at peace with themselves, I guess.
From what I can tell, I would say yes. Although I'm sure, you know, you have those moments at night, the demons show up. You get that diagnosis, and I think you decide you're going to spend the remainder doing what you want to do or always wanted to do.
And that's something that a lot of people don't ever achieve in their lives, doing what they want to do. And in some ways, I guess you're there. You're doing what you want to do. No one is forcing you to travel, are they?
No. There's a price to be paid. I think travel's not all glamour. It's not all fun adventures. Sometimes there's some pretty rough spot. And I wonder myself too what it is that compels me to do what I'm doing. Why don't I just stay home and just get a regular job and lead a regular life? I think at root of wanderlust probably is discontent. You know, I don't want to lead a gray half-life. I'd rather just go out there and embrace the world for good and worse. Do it while I still can. I'm no longer a spring chicken, and see what comes of it.
That's the whole essence of having an adventure, like you're having, and it is an adventure, is the fact that, look, there's great times and there are some really horrible times. But I bet when you reflect on some of the things you've done and some of the places you've been to and some of the situations that you have been involved with,
right,
that basically you would have a very positive outlook on that.
Yes, you do. Even the worst times, even being stuck in a crappy hotel room with typhoid and Varanasi, and kind of weirdly even look back on that with fondness, under the sheltering skies kind of fondness. That's what it's about. You're dealing with the challenges on a day-to-day basis. I'm not the same person I was 5 years ago. I'm not even the same person I was a year ago.
Are you more tolerant or less tolerant, or doesn't tolerance come into it?
More tolerant, more open-minded, more accepting of things.
And you would have to be less judgmental, because the way you are traveling, you are staying with ordinary people in some fairly dire circumstances, and I guess you can't judge them by the standards that you grew up with.
Oh, no. I mean, hell, they're living better than I am. if anything, I'm the curiosity. There's not too many people here in Pai cooking over a campfire, because it's just so much cheaper than eating out in the restaurants. I eat better, too, though. You learn to cook.
Yep.
You learn how to make a fire real fast, even in the rain. It's a way of life. I think it's a unique way of life, but I don't think I would really fit in if I went back to the West.
It is a way of life that you have chosen for yourself. And that is one thing that probably most people, they just can't do.
Why?
Well, because of circumstances, because of responsibilities, because of family commitments, because in many cases people need a particular income, otherwise, you know, they're in dire trouble. And so they have to put up with perhaps a bad job or a bad relationship or living in a place they don't want to be. Whereas you've really done away with all that, and you have chosen a particular lifestyle for yourself, which obviously wouldn't suit many people, but it does suit you.
It does. My own personal view on that is that, well, this is only a one-way ticket. It's only, you only have the one life. That's my own personal belief, of course. And I choose to live it by my own terms. If my own terms end up killing me, then so be it. At least I went out there. I've spent many years working in drudgery jobs and that, and just feeling my soul ground to dust, and that whole cliche. And I'm in my late 50s now. I just look at the math and realize I might have another 15, 20 years where I can do what I want to do. And I'm just going to take it. You know, there's many other horrible things that can happen. You know, a diagnosis of cancer, a car accident, another financial crash. You know, you just don't know what's going to happen.
Well, Michael, look, it's been fascinating talking to you. I love talking to people like you who get out on their own, who you have chosen a particular path for yourself, and you are living the life that you want to lead. And I just think that is sensational.
And just to cap it, I just have to say, I really hope it doesn't kill me.
So do I, Michael. But then again, I suppose, you know what? Death is a very important part of life, and it's going to get us some stage.
Yeah, yeah. It's hard to look at the ground in the same way as always.
It is. Michael Britton, artist, writer, adventurer, it's been terrific talking to you.
Okay, yeah, same here. Thanks, Steve.